just there on our porch.
Can I help you?
James gave the batter a flick. He wasn't wearing his glasses and squinted into the light. Mud turned, surprised to hear a man's voice. He looked at me over James's shoulder.
Same deal as last time.
I hadn't told James about driving Mud to work. After all, he no longer told me the minutiae of his days, the way he had when he'd first started teaching, when I'd known all the students' names and their brief young resumes. I was only being neighborly, charitable. It would have been like telling James every time I gave a dollar to the Cerebral Palsy Fund in those round metal jars at the movies, or cooed at someone's less-than-handsome baby. Sorry, Mud, we're in the middle of making breakfast. I scooted in front of James, blocking the doorway with my arm. Beneath the orange hat, Mud's face began to glow slightly pink, like skin after a punch. He nodded, turned away, and trudged slowly down the steps and back toward his house. Penny drive at school, I said to James as I shut the door, pushing his back toward the kitchen. Like UNICEF, you know? For Sudanese refugee camps, I think. I shook my head, saying, it's nothing. I wasn't sure why I was lying to him.
He's still in school.
James put the bowl of batter down on the counter beside the stove and stuck a finger in the pale, milky goo. Community college, I think. I tried to think of a single thing Mud might be interested in enough to continue his studies. Auto repair, maybe. Accessory design.
Huh.
James turned the knob for one of the back burners. We listened to the slow clicking of the igniter, watching for the short blue flames to appear. Margaret came around one night with flyers. In addition to her work with the neighborhood committee, she also volunteered at the Eastside Senior Center, which occupied two small buildings across the narrow river near our house. Some of the members were putting on a show, an abbreviated production of Guys and Dolls, which turned out to mean a handful of scenes that could all use the same props and backdrop. James had to stay late at work, as it was nearly midterms, so I went alone and stood in the back. Rows of folding chairs were set up in what looked like a dining hall, with a small wooden platform at the back of the room. The overhead lights were dimmed, but there was still enough light that the residents with canes could see what they were about to trip over. Three of the Nelson kids were working at the makeshift concession stand, where a slice of chocolate cake was a dollar and glasses of milk were free. Margaret, I understood from seeing her flit about with a plastic bag full of safety pins and a feather boa draped around her neck, was doing costumes, which made me like her more. A 73-year-old woman wearing a nightie got up on stage. She had the lithe legs of a former dancer, and even though her voice was shaky, I knew by the way the men in the audience held their hands over their heads to clap that she was a hit before she sang a note. Margaret had painted the woman's lips magenta, so even from the back of the room I could see her mouth open and close. In the city, she would have been a 30-year-old guy in drag, legs and chest waxed, fake eyelashes and wrinkles. If I'd had a friend next to me, I would have squeezed her arm and said, "Can you believe this?" But kitsch wasn't kitsch if you were alone. I could hardly hear the woman's voice, but I knew all the words to the song and mouthed along with her. My grandmother Sophie had lived in a place like this, and all I remembered were the hallways full of people who'd suddenly found themselves single after 50 years. They'd had a little chapel on the ground floor, wheelchair accessible, and they had lots of weddings. No one's family ever understood. If I died, I wanted James to get married again as soon as possible, either to a librarian or a reporter for a trashy magazine. It was something we'd discussed. After the performance, I found Margaret standing by the side of the stage, her cheeks flushed with success. She was folding clothes and neatly putting her little bags back into a rolling suitcase. She'd given herself a swipe of the bright lipstick, and her thin lips seemed to hover a few inches in front of her face. "Oh, Sophie!" She was surprised to see me, and opened a plastic wallet of baby wipes and quickly doused her face, removing all but a pinkish smudge on her chin. "I thought it was just wonderful, Margaret. Thanks for inviting me. La grip, la grip, la post nasal drip." I sang a few bars to prove that I'd been paying attention. Sometimes James asked me to sing to him while he mashed the potatoes. The shrillness of your voice makes it go faster, he'd say, whirring away. The electric masher and I competed for volume in the kitchen, which was big enough to have a slight echo. One of these days we'd have to buy some more furniture. Maybe in Milwaukee. Maybe in Boise. Maybe in the Yukon. Her face relaxed, which made her look both older and prettier. Mud didn't look anything like her, except for a little bit around the eyes. They both always wanted to look away. That's very nice of you to say. She paused and looked at me the way a girl in a clothing store would, before inaccurately overestimating your size, or worse, getting you the correct size, which you'd rather not be. Mud has told me that you've been very friendly to him. I was surprised to hear that Mud spoke to his mother in full sentences, that he knew the word friendly. Your son is an interesting individual, I said. Clowns were interesting. People on death row were interesting. Mud qualified. She lowered her gaze and nodded, smiling to herself. A feather from the boa around her neck disengaged itself, and we watched it fall to the floor in slow swoops. At first, the siren sounded like a passing ambulance, just a vehicle in a hurry. The ringing continued, though, and when I looked out the bedroom window, the backyard seemed lit for a movie set, as though it were night, but with hidden floodlights illuminating each blade of grass, each shuddering leaf. The bed was empty. It was Thursday, a teaching day, and James had been gone for hours. If we'd stayed in New York, it would have been a real movie set. Once James came home, we would have gone outside and seen who the stars were, where their trailers were parked, what the craft service table had laid out for the crew. But it wasn't a set. The sky was really that yellow. The wind picked up and whistled through the branches, sending dying leaves to the ground outside my window. Dorothy came to mind, Kansas in black and white. One was supposed to stand in a doorway, under furniture, in the basement. I put on my slippers and walked over to the kitchen. It was the twilight zone on the other side of the house, too, but there was a light in the basement next door. Mud didn't look as surprised as I thought he might when I knocked. Maybe he thought I needed to borrow his bicycle to go stock up on bottled water and batteries, cans of soup, whatever it is one is supposed to have on hand in case of an emergency. Can I come in? The tornado siren kept howling. Where were the speakers? It was like going to a concert and sitting on one side next to the amplifier. Everything skewed toward distortion. In answer, Mud started walking back down the stairs. I ducked in quickly behind him before the door closed. I hoped his mother wasn't watching. Across the street, the Nelsons were probably performing search and rescue missions for all the neighborhood cats. The basement looked like what it was, a refuge. There weren't the posters I expected or the level of filth. A television was on, pointing the other direction. There was a pizza box and some empty beer bottles, but mostly the space was clean. It even smelled good. Do you vacuum? I asked. Mud looked offended.
Don't you?
Not really. I think my husband does, sometimes. Yeah. But no, I don't. Honestly, I don't really clean the house that much. Something started to tap against the window. Ting, ting, like a tiny bell.
Well, I guess that's the hell.
Mud looked at my feet. I still had on my worn terry cloth slippers.
Those waterproof?
The basement was one large room. He must have had to go up into the house to use the kitchen, although there was a mini fridge, the kind kids have in their dorm rooms. It was like a loft in Tribeca, only with wall-to-wall carpet and no windows. It was practically cosmopolitan. There were even books. I stooped to look at the spines. Wedged in between the bird field guides and almanacs were novels. Novels James taught. Novels I hadn't read.
You going to move? Mud said.
I shifted my body out of the way, although it didn't appear that I was blocking anything.
No, Mud shook his head. I mean out of town.
Maybe, I said. I guess it depends on my husband.
You don't have a real job? Do you?
I asked. Mud crossed his arms over his chest. He looked like the bouncer at the kind of nightclub that's well stocked with pasties and spangled G-strings.
I exhaled. I think I'm still working on that.
So, you're from New York?
I nodded.
What was it like?
Mud walked behind me and ran his finger across his rows of books.
Was it like in the movies?
I didn't know how to tell him that nothing was as much like the movies as the last month of my life, when strange women brought me lemonade and baked goods, which I then consumed without worry that I was being poisoned for the lease to my co-op. That this street, where he had lived his entire life, was more beautiful than anywhere I'd ever been able to afford. That the only extreme weather that mattered in New York was when the air conditioning went out on the subway. That it was just a place, like any other place, where people lived. The TV flashed a blue square on the wall behind Mud's bed. Even before I walked around to see what was on, I knew what I would find there. Two enormous saline-filled breasts bounced inches away from the camera, as someone rocked her hips back and forth somewhere below the sight line. I turned away before the director decided to change the angle. "Do you mind?" I said. Mud shrugged. I crossed my arms over my chest, as though it would make either of us forget that I had breasts too. But Mud seemed neither bothered nor embarrassed by my request. He lumbered over next to me, picked up the remote, and shut off the television.
"It's not a big deal," Mud said,
and he was right. The actors had jobs, just like he did, just like James. They had a schedule and health insurance. They called their mothers when they remembered to do so. I thought about my mother standing on her back porch, surveying the rhododendrons. We all had to fill our days. We took turns standing at the top of the stairs, staring out the glass pane of the window, waiting for the rain to stop, watching the fat drops of water hit my house, the trees, the shed. A puddle grew on my driveway. Across the street, my telephone might have been ringing. James could have walked by a window at school, seen the deluge, and thought to check up on me. I wondered what he'd have thought if he'd known where I was. There was gossip and there was slander. It would have been too much. When he came home, I would tell him I'd ridden out the storm in the bathtub, alone. Mud aimed his rifle at the squirrel that had just shimmied up the tree in my yard, one of the biggest trees on the whole street. The squirrel had discovered an apple core that Mud had conveniently left sitting in the grass, alongside a handful of salted nuts, mostly cashews and almonds. Hunters, he told me, knew how to use good bait. I stood over his right shoulder, careful to stay out of the way, should the gun kick back. His extra gun lay flat against my shoulder. "Do you ever think about moving out, you know, out of your parents' house?" I ate a small handful of nuts with my free hand, chewing them as quietly as possible so as not to disturb our quarry. He spoke without turning around.
"Not really. I like it here. I have the whole basement."
I nodded, even though he couldn't see me, and tucked my hair behind my ears. Mud told me that when it got really cold, he'd tell me where to get a good hat. A car turned down our block. It was my car. James was home early. He pulled into our narrow garage, which was a lighter shade of pink than the house. I heard the engine rumble off. The world was overwhelmingly quiet. Even the squirrel in the tree stopped nibbling and scratching. James would want to know what I was doing, crouching in the yard with Mud, my feet straddling the remains of a flower bed, a borrowed BB gun snug in my armpit, when I was supposed to be at work. I would have to explain it to him. I could just tell him my path was not about coffee or gossip. It was about something else. Real estate, maybe. Standing there, waiting for my husband to emerge from the garage, I thought about how each time you moved, you left behind more and more. The antique furniture, the soft, faded T-shirts, the garbage and then the garbage cans themselves. Until maybe one day you were left with only what you could carry on your back and what was packed inside your own skin. The abandoned addresses would line up on the front lawn, and knowing you wouldn't miss them, turn their backs as you drove away. Now that we'd left New York, we were already floating in space, tethered only to each other. When James stepped out of the garage, his body no wider than a sapling, I raised the butt of the gun to my shoulder and peered through the sight.
"Sophie?"
he said, his voice lilting up, as though unsure if it was really me. He held his briefcase in front of his body, a paper-filled bulletproof vest.
"What are you doing out here?"
"Pow," I said, smiling. James took a few steps closer, until only a single row of dead plants lay between us.
"Sophie, would you come inside with me?"
James asked quietly. This was a key to public negotiation. We'd seen so many couples have it out on the sidewalk, stumbling out of nightclubs. Remaining calm in the face of uncertainty could prevent almost any disaster.
Mud chuckled.
"Shut up," I said, and he did. In one motion, I snapped the barrel of the gun back toward the sky. Over our heads, clouds scurried out of the way. James stepped aside, into a dead rose bush the house's previous inhabitants had killed before we were even given the chance. I crossed in front of him, brushing the hair across my forehead with my free hand, as I might before a job interview, making sure I looked my best. Behind me, I heard Mud start to say something about the gun I was still holding, and then he stopped himself abruptly, as if he thought I might need it wherever I was going. Other People We Married. The advertisement had been gloriously distorted. What did it say? 3-bed, 2-bath cottage on the water, with boat, slip, and dock. Private beach. Great for families. Was that it? It was like something Edward Gorey might have drawn, with a little girl skipping to her death. The thing barely held Bobby in his fire truck, and he was only 3. Great for families looking to off each other in the peace and quiet of the vineyard, is what it should have said. Jim would have put his foot down, always eager for his creature comforts. Franny just wanted to get out of the city, go somewhere with the beach. She still thought she was a cow with her leftover baby weight and yet insisted on wearing those stupid pigtails all young mothers seem to think it's their right to wear, as if they were all waiting, gasping, praying for someone to say, "Oh, you? You can't be the mother of this child. You couldn't possibly be old enough." Charles was just along for the ride, the fourth wheel. Bobby might have been small, but he was family, and Charles was something extra. Jim drove the Saab. It was little and black and frankly impractical for someone with limbs as long as his, but it was his car and he loved it. He'd fold himself into the front seat like a Chinese acrobat and then wait for everyone else to climb in, Charles in front and Franny in back with the baby. Bobby had a booster seat that he was strapped into, the kind of thing that made most kids wail and squirm. But he sat there quietly eating his Cheerios, always listening to his mother when she pointed out things they passed on the highway. Horses, fire trucks, hamburger stands. Franny had found the ad. The New York Review of Books ran pages of classifieds. Its back pages were always filled with idyllic retreats somewhere or other, and more often than not, a handsome older gentleman to share them with you. She sometimes cut those out for Charles, too. She'd crack up reading them aloud. "Listen to this one, Charlie. He's perfect for you. Long baths and foot rubs. Looking for someone to enjoy my impressive wine cellar and library. M4M. Impressive wine cellar? Do you think that means no twist-offs? Or maybe that's what he's looking for, some good twist-offs. What do you think?" It was unclear if Jim ever got to weigh in on whether Charles came along on their family vacations. It was doubtful. Jim was her husband, but Charles was her man. And if Franny wanted him along, well, then he was going. Martha's Vineyard was always a nightmare to get to, and Franny, despite her formidable organizational skills, never seemed to time things quite right. That year they showed up 3 minutes before the last ferry, instead of half an hour before the one they were booked on, which had departed hours earlier. Luckily, Franny was great with uniformed personnel. Jim and Charles stood by the car with their arms crossed, Bobby crouching between their shins with his fire truck. The three of them watched Fran reason with the ferry ticket boy. He was about 18, covered in pimples, and didn't have a shot in hell. His supervisor, maybe all of 20, lasted about a minute, made her laugh 3 times, and their passage was secured. It was already dark outside when they got to the island, and Bobby snored quietly in the back seat, now in his mother's arms. Jim said the directions were bad, and it was too dark to read them anyway, and this couldn't be where they were going. The cottage would have been more aptly described as a shack. It was sharp around the edges and saggy in the middle, the kind of place that kids briefly sleep in before getting slashed to death by homicidal maniacs in horror movies. Franny, what's the address again? 21 Mill Pond Lane? I think that sign read Mill Pond Street. We must be in the wrong place. Jim craned his neck, and even though the inside of the car was too dark to see discernible features, Charles knew his mouth was pointing down in that creaky old way. Some parts of Jim always looked like they would be better on a man of advanced age. That was something nice about blondes. They could go white or gray without anyone ever really noticing, because what was the difference? There had been a little Cruella de Vil in him from the start. That was what Charles liked most about Jim, the frosty undercurrent of detachment when Franny wasn't around. The car was rolling along slowly, half a mile an hour. The driveway was gravel, and the Saab snored loudly. The nearby houses were all lit up, nice big normal houses with roofs and proper kitchens and bathrooms and probably jet skis in the garages. Franny opened the back door to the car and jumped out before either of the men could tell her not to, and went skipping up to the house. She cupped her hands around her eyes and tried to look in through the door. No, this is it! This is it! She spun around on her heels, the headlights of the car tracking her like a spotlight. She did a little pirouette on the porch, her dark pigtails twirling out to the side, and Jim stopped the car. In the light, the house wasn't that bad. It was worse. There were three bedrooms lined up end to end like Alice in Wonderland, with one door leading straight to the next, like what newspaper ads politely called railroad apartments, but were in reality nothing more than glorified hallways. This house was no different. The three bedrooms were carved out of a single hall, leading down toward the dock. The fatter part of the house, the hand to the bedroom's thumb, had been a quaint little cottage once upon a time. The house did have three bedrooms. The house did have a dock. The house did have Massachusetts' appropriate knickknacks on every available surface. What it didn't have: charm, clean towels, two forks that matched, pots with lids, anything remotely childproof, a full-length mirror, or level floorboards. Franny and Charles drove Jim's car into town and bought some cheapo plastic lawn chairs. There are always more stores in the vineyard than you ever remembered. More tiny little mom-and-pop places that grew from the ashes of other mom-and-pop places after the old people died and their kids decided to move to Boston to live like normal people, where peanut butter and toilet paper weren't overpriced imports. Bobby and Charles sat in the back, both strapped in like good little boys, while Franny drove slowly through the streets.
I swear, I thought he was going to kill you.
Charles looked over at Bobby. How early did children learn the word kill? He smiled and kicked his feet around. He'd been running for what seemed like forever, but didn't talk much. Everyone struggled to get a word in edgewise with Fran. Who? Her sunglasses took up half her face, like something out of Charlie's Angels. Charlie's post-pregnancy weight angel. Charlie's frozen custard angel. Charlie's fag hag angel. Franny was mugging for him in the rearview mirror. Jim? Is that his name? Franny was being bad, and Charlie was happy to play along.
I forget. I was too drunk at your wedding. I wasn't paying attention. Yes, Jim. You could have called the Better Business Bureau or the Vineyard Mounties or something. I'm sure there are other rentals. It's not a holiday weekend.
And what fun would that have been? She spied a parking spot and yelped with joy. See? We're having fun already. Bobby joined his mother in a laugh at his father's expense. The shopping list wasn't very long, just some hamburger meat to go along with the fixings they'd packed in the trunk. They hadn't lied about the barbecue, although it looked as though it hadn't been cleaned since its date of inception. Franny thought it would lend some flavor, like a cast-iron skillet. Jim pushed her aside and started the fire. Wine, a rubber ball, and a flimsy kite for Bobby. More wine. Franny loved to shop. It hardly mattered where. She loved those stupid tourist shops with printed t-shirts and ashtrays, the stuff no one ever wants. She cooed over all of it. Look, Charlie. It's a tiny little sandbox, only it's an ashtray and you put your cigarettes out in the sand. Bobby exercised remarkable restraint. Charles encouraged her. They came home with a t-shirt for each of them, There, too, already on their backs, and Jim's in Franny's lap, at the ready.
Jim rolled his eyes and asked where the meat was.
His wife handed over the drooping plastic bag, and he took it inside to pummel and season, leaving Fran and Charles to open the wine. The dock was 20 feet or so long, and Charles thought he'd set up his supplies there, maybe paint some picturesque water scenes with naked Bobby at the edge, Buddha belly extended. Franny always wanted to be painted as a bohemian, even though she'd left the 60s with her bra intact and hairless legs. Little Franny Gold. She always said she would have kept her name, or at least hyphenated it, if Goldpost hadn't sounded less like a slurring football announcer. Her parents lived on Eastern Parkway, in what would have been a $1 million apartment if it had been on Park Avenue. Every surface dust-free, even if he showed up unannounced. The Golds would not have tolerated a bohemian.
Don't draw pictures of me drinking. You're going to make me look like a wino.
Franny's whole mouth was already purple. The wine was cheap and made their lips pucker, but only at first.
Of course not, Charles said, finishing the bowl of the wine glass with a fat charcoal line.
Behind them, Jim stood with his back to the water, prodding the meat on the grill. A cool breeze rustled Charles's papers and sent tiny red sparks out from under the barbecue.
Careful, Jim. We don't want to set the house on fire, Charles called out. You mean this is a before? How could they tell the difference?
He was still mad. Once he ate, he would be better. He was like a teenager, sullen until his belly was full. Jim kept talking with his back to them. The conversation aimed at no one, all mumbled curse words.
So, Charlie, I was thinking, she stage whispered, cupping her hand around her mouth to block the sound from Jim, who wasn't listening anyway. What do you think about smoking a little P.O.T.?
She opened her eyes wide in mock surprise.
I know you brought some. He doesn't have to know.
What about Bobby?
He was already asleep inside, taking the second of his two daily naps, a habit Charles fully intended to steal.
Let's not tell him.
More for us. She scrunched up her nose, sending little wavy lines of wickedness across her cheeks.
You are so bad, Fran.
She nodded and took another sip. Someone in a canoe slid by, gliding across the surface and waved. Franny waved back, smiling. Doobie, doobie doo. The dying sunlight was in her eyes, painting her skin a warmer color than it usually was. This is how Charles would paint her. This warm, this pink.
Love you, Charlie, she said.
She knew the light suited her. Whenever she felt particularly presentable or pleased with herself, Franny slipped into this Katharine Hepburn voice, all sass and class. For a slightly round Jewish girl from Brooklyn, that was pretty much the top of the heap. Before the wedding, when Franny was cloistered away in some hidden chamber of the synagogue with her mother fixing every defiant hair on her head, Jim and Charles had sat alone in his dressing room, which also seemed to be the Hebrew school classroom. Charles leaned against the lip of the teacher's desk, and Jim sat opposite him in an orange plastic chair, the seat of which looked like it was made to hold a 10-year-old's slim hips and little else. Their suit jackets hung beside each other, the hangers hooked over the doorframe, two swaying old friends. Some people looked great in black suits, spruced up and handsome, and Jim was one of them. Charles looked more like a waiter than Cary Grant or even Warren Beatty. It was 3 days after Passover, and the largest wall in the room was covered with hand-drawn interpretations of the Seder plate. One poor girl had been assigned the brown nutty stuff, and the drawing could easily have passed for what accumulates at the bottom of a rabbit's cage.
Why is this night different from all other nights? Jim squinted a little. Well, let's see. We're in a synagogue. You're marrying Franny. I'd say there are a shitload of reasons, wouldn't you?
Jim smiled and pointed to the blackboard behind Charles, where his question was written in chalk.
Oh, right. What can I say? The only holidays I ever celebrated had to do with birthdays. Mine or Jesus's,
Charles said, seeming slightly embarrassed. Outside, the sun was just starting to lower itself gently into the horizon. It wouldn't be much longer before Franny's father came to get them. All the Posts and the Golds and their friends were already assembled in the large room next door, waiting to bear witness to the blessed event. Charles tried to fix his hair in the small, waist-high mirror on the back of the door. The glass was covered with smudgy fingerprints, evidence that people had been there before, beaten him to the punch. Charles wondered how Fran was doing, if her mother was driving her crazy. He could imagine little Mrs. Gold wielding two aerosol cans, trying to shellac Franny's curls into quiet submission.
Thanks for doing this, Charlie.
Jim stood next to Charles's reflection in the mirror, their tuxedoed lower halves both cut off at the belly button.
It means a lot, having you here. Where else would I be?
The thought of Franny getting married without Charles seemed so wrong. They could have done it without Jim, maybe, but not without him. Who would she have talked to? They could have filled him in later, told him all his lines, how handsome he was. They would have looked into each other's eyes and known, yes, this was forever.
I mean, I figure if you're standing up there, Fran probably won't run out the door.
Jim shoved his hands in his pockets where they could twitch in peace. He was nervous.
I don't think she'd run anyway.
Charles turned to face him. Jim's eyes were boring a hole in the wooden floor, his eyebrows high wires across his forehead.
No? No way. Too much energy. That's practically cardiovascular exercise. I think she'd just sneak out the back. You know, catch a cab.
Jim put his hand over his heart, wounded.
Guess I'm lucky you'll be there to stop her then, huh?
He loved Franny. Charles could see that. Jim had the sense to love her, and so Charles had no choice but to love him, too.
I'd bring her right back.
Someone rapped their knuckles against the door. Franny was ready. And who were they to keep her waiting? Bobby had to keep his shoes on whenever he was out of bed due to rusty nails and other miscellaneous dangers, which meant that each thundering little step was amplified. Fran and Jim took the proper bedroom, which left Charles to the bunk beds, which in turn left him with no sleep whatsoever. Dear thing that he was, Bobby was up at 6 every morning, running back and forth, hitting every loud spot in the floor. The walls, perhaps unsurprisingly, were made of a material that could best be described as loose-leaf paper, and so Charles at least knew for certain that he wasn't the only miserable grump in the house. Franny woke when Bobby woke. She fed him some yogurt and bananas, which Charles knew because she sang him a little song while she was doing it, dictating every one of her movements.
And now I mash the bananas with my little fork, and here comes the yogi, a mush, a mush, a mush.
Franny could not then, nor could she ever, carry a tune, even one of her own invention. Charles could hear groaning from the other bedroom. Bobby finished breakfast, and before Charles knew what was happening, there was a song about cleaning off his face. There was a knock at the door, and then, like it or not, he was babysitting. Charles was still half naked, half asleep, and almost entirely pissed off at Fran. But there Bobby was, little boy wonder, saying, "Drawing?" And what could he do, really? He reached up his arms, asking plaintively for Charles to lift him onto the creaky bottom bunk. His hair was still fair then, closer to Jim's color, and as he sat in front of Charles, waiting patiently for the art supplies to appear, Charles was struck by the fact that he and Bobby had remarkably similar hairlines. Wisps in the front, more solid cover in the back, long dangly bits on top that hung down across their foreheads. They were two marooned teenage surfers who the undertow had cruelly spit up on the coast of Balding. The door to Fran and Jim's room slammed shut, which was a feat in and of itself, given that the door didn't weigh anything. Feet, Franny's, padded loudly across the floor, presumably toward the bed her husband was still sleeping in.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Most children are accustomed to hearing the sound of their parents' voices in all sorts of situations. How else do children learn the meaning of words like yell, or scream, or bloody murder? Bobby clearly was going to have no problem remembering any of the above. She'd always been a good fighter, but in the years she'd been married to Jim, Fran and Charles hadn't had any major arguments. Now he understood why. She was using that energy elsewhere. In the next room, an object fell to the floor. It was a small object, nothing breakable, but nevertheless, it unleashed something powerful out of the slumbering Jim. The last time Charles had heard them fight was when the three of them were all traveling to London together. Three broke kids, and his tiny little shoebox of a room was right next to theirs, with a similarly thin wall. Jim and Charles were showering simultaneously, each in their own rooms, and when Charles flushed the toilet after his shower, Jim's water went ice cold, which Charles could tell from the angry yelp ringing through the wall.
Across the room, Franny poured herself a glass of water from the tap, and she got blamed for what was clearly Charles's error in judgment. Jim screamed at her, sure that she had done it on purpose. They weren't so serious yet, and Franny loved to play games. She might have done it on purpose, and in any case, couldn't be sure that she hadn't ruined his shower accidentally. The only thing worse than hearing them argue was hearing them have sex, which usually followed. Of course, that was before Bobby. They were trying not to yell at first, as it was quite clear that Charles could hear every word they were saying. Franny was more effective than her husband in this regard, probably because she cared that Charles knew that she was being yelled at, while Jim had no such reservation. One of the nice things about being friends with a couple is that one usually gets to hear both sides of an argument without hearing the argument itself. And so, over the course of, say, 10 years, you know them better than they know themselves, and with none of the pyrotechnics. Sometimes, however, one finds oneself in the next bedroom, with nowhere to go, and nothing to do but listen. Jim, this fucking bed! Franny, Bobby! Jim, and the fucking smile! Franny, adventure my... Jim, about what I wanted! Franny, coo... Jim, no! Franny, yes! This went on for several more minutes, increasing in volume with each point. When they were still courting, Jim and Franny used to fight everywhere. Pizza parlors, bowling lanes, the office bathroom. It was something they liked about each other. Charles wanted the opposite. Find someone calm, that's what he said to himself. Ferdinand the Bull was the ideal mate. Tough on the outside, soft on the inside, and the opposite of both Jim and Fran. It just wasn't worth it. Jim, and then you and Charlie. Franny, oh, Jim, please. Jim, and the fucking house. Franny, but love. Jim, fucking drunks, at least. Franny, don't you dare. Jim, at least Charlie's. Here's where Jim called Charles a faggot. He'd done it before, Charles knew, and liked to think that they could say things like that to one another. After all, Charles had slept in the same bed as his wife nearly as many times as he had before they got married. They were family, Jim must have thought. It was okay. It was entirely different, however, to hear it through the wall, when none of Jim's wry charm was attached, and when, technically, Charles wasn't listening. Franny, to her credit, went ballistic, literally bouncing off pieces of furniture like a ricocheted bullet, her voice higher and tinnier than usual. She sounded like a chihuahua trapped in an overheated car, bless her. There were other words that bothered her more. Moist, inexplicably, and kike, which no one even used anymore. But faggot was pretty high on her list. Meanwhile, Bobby had put down the crepas and pushed aside the sheet of newsprint he and Charles had been sharing, crumpling its corners with his sneakered feet as he lay down with his head in Charles's lap, bringing his tiny little fist up to the ear not already muffled by Charles's shin. After a few minutes, the papery door opened and slammed again. Softer footsteps this time. Jim padded down the hall, still in his cotton pajamas, so old-fashioned, like somebody's father, which, of course, he already was. Although it was funny to think about Bobby growing up to be an actual person and not just a downy little lump made in Franny's image. The Saab rumbled awake, and he drove off, erasing the driveway in one easy stroke. Where could he go in his pajamas, really? He couldn't get out of the car. He probably didn't have his wallet. Charles was just starting to imagine Jim getting pulled over, going 90 on some tiny little beach road and having to explain to the officer that his license and registration were in his pants, in his room, in his crappy rental house. The cop would understand, of course. Jim was a man's man, all about the unspoken codes of machismo. The cop had a wife, too. He would recognize the color in Jim's cheek, the sleep still in his eyes, and he would send him off without even a warning. Maybe even tell him about a particularly good route for some angry driving. There was a knock on the door. Franny was too upset to be shy about crying. Her whole face was red and damp, like some kind of Goya midwife, dark and angry. "Want to go for a swim, duckies?" she laughed. And it was a little bit snotty. She had to blow her nose. Bobby pushed himself up onto all fours and wagged his bottom like a tail. Franny walked over to the bed and scooped him up in her arms. Her forearm brushed against Charles's leg, and she looked at him, smiling. "It's okay," she said,
to both of them and to herself.
Mommy's okay. Mommy's okay.
The water below the dock was warm enough for swimming, at least in the sunshine. Bobby treated the entire crumbling thing like a pirate ship, full of hidden treasures and things that were good by virtue of their very dangerous nature. He was so straight even then. Franny and Charles had talked about Bobby growing up to be gay, what the likelihood was. He just wasn't, though. It was easy enough to tell. He liked balls and bats and running and farts and his father's car. The sand was more like dirt, rocky like the rest of New England and nothing special. Franny and Charles kept their shoes on to wade in, two pairs of canvas sneakers ballooning in size under the water. They were looking for wildlife, but they seemed to be the only specimens out so early.
"He's funny, you know,"
Fran said, facing Bobby, who was jumping off the dock into his mother's arms again and again. He bent his knees and jumped straight up, his tiny back pushing itself forward as though his spine could come right through his ribs. He shot himself like a cannon was behind him, every appendage flying.
"What? You mean all that fag stuff? That really is funny. He should quit the review and do stand-up, don't you think?"
The water was waist high, and the upper half of Charles's body was trying its best to cultivate the kind of tan that would make the trip worthwhile.
"Come on, I'm being serious."
Franny made an oomph sound as she caught Bobby in her arms, sending him into a peal of laughter.
"I'm sorry you had to hear us. We really don't do it that often, that kind of yelling, I mean."
She was lying, which was all right. It was her marriage, after all.
"It's just that, you know."
Bobby ran back down the pier to fetch a plastic truck the size of his head.
"Everything is different now."
"You're not, though, and neither is he, really."
Charles's voice was angrier than he wanted it to be.
"You're still hilarious and he's still a yaley wasp with a stick up his ass. And I mean that in the least fun way possible."
"Not in front of Bobby."
Franny opened her arms for the flying little body. Bobby's feet hit the water, a surprise bonus.
Splash, splash, splash.
Franny twirled his tight frame around in a circle, dragging his feet across the surface of the water, sending ripples outward into the big, wide world of which Bobby was the center. She had someone else to take care of now. The Saab and its master purred back up the driveway around 11. Jim had, apparently, had the time to put on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt before peeling off, and so he could have gotten out of the car to stretch his legs, buy a newspaper, eat breakfast. Charles should have known. Jim was never one to leave things to chance. He was too well turned out for things like that. He always put his wallet in the same place. His passport, his keys, his whatever. Even their medicine cabinet was organized. It was easy to tell which things were his. The muscle balm, the vitamins. As far as Charles knew, Jim had never had indigestion, diarrhea, constipation, insomnia, depression, hives, warts, or pimples. Walking back in from the car, with the sun shining right on top of his head like a goddamn golden halo, even Charles could tell why Franny loved him. He was like a living, breathing cologne advertisement. He should have ridden horses and played polo. Bobby took one look at his father and was off running and 1, 2, 3 straight into Jim's arms. Charles thought it might be possible that things would have wound up differently, with Jim softening into imperfection. But watching him with Bobby, whom he tossed into the air with all the passion of a 10-buck-an-hour babysitter, he doubted it. Franny waded back out, leaving Charles alone in the water. It was warmer now, with the sun more directly overhead. He drifted backward to float on his back, his canvas-covered toes splayed out to the sides like wayward rudders. Charles watched as Franny tugged her swimsuit out of her bottom, adjusting herself for whatever Jim was about to say. She hadn't washed her hair or even brushed it, and even the wet parts were flattened at weird angles. The water moved Charles slowly back, back into the ocean. He wondered how long he could float before hitting something. A passing boat. Africa. His ears slipped above and below the surface, filling up with glugs and noises from the watery depths. Charles could have heard what they were saying to each other, but he didn't. She'd tell him later, putting the emphasis on whatever she felt had been the most submissive, gentle thing Jim had said. In her version, she wouldn't have had that look on her face, or the pouty lip. That much Charles knew for sure. Sometimes it was best to let people believe what they want to about themselves, especially Franny, who was held together with barbed wire and a thick coating of marshmallow fluff. One of the houses nearby had a flag up. Nothing he recognized. Some secret sailing message going out to the initiated, and it waved lazily in the wind.
You and me, it was saying. You and me.
Fuck them. Stay in the water. Back at the office, they all said they'd had a great time. Franny had had the best time of all, of course. You could hear her laugh from anywhere in the office, even from Charles's desk, which was on the floor below. She would pull someone aside, anyone, it hardly mattered, and start to tell them a story in a whisper. But by the time she got to the end, she'd be speaking at full volume, hoping to call more listeners. Everyone liked to be singled out, and so by the end of the week, Franny had had special little tete-a-tetes with half the staff, including the cleaning ladies. Charles would walk by her in the hall on his way to the big color Xerox, and she and her big red mouth would be performing something out of Gypsy, all for the benefit of Nina from Ecuador. Usually, for lunch, they walked over to one of the delis with the enormous sandwiches. Sure, there were always tourists and flashbulbs, but the potato pancakes covered in sour cream and applesauce would make you forget. As her best friend, maybe Charles should have tried to help Franny watch her waistline. But he was still mad, having spent the five-hour drive back to the city listening to her laugh uproariously at Jim's every syllable. He didn't care if she ended up wearing bedsheets. Charles ordered a cream soda and pastrami. Franny got the tuna, which he supposed was the diet choice on the menu. But they gave you so much of it that it was roughly equivalent to eating an entire jar of mayonnaise. The ancient waitresses stuck straws and pens in their aprons and made smacking sounds with their gigantic lipsticked mouths, pausing only to silently scold people when they ordered white bread instead of rye. Even when everything was in tip-top shape, though, and the rabbit was behaving itself, they never moved very quickly. Perhaps they put that in the ad. Must have wide hips and move like an elephant. I really am sorry about Jim. Franny's mouth stretched open to jam in a corner of her sandwich. The flimsy pieces of bread on the top and bottom of the tuna fish bowling ball didn't stand a chance, nor did Franny's skirt, which acted as an impromptu safety net for falling pieces of wet, salty fish.
As in, sorry you married a bigot?
He plunked a fallen piece of pastrami into his mouth and washed it down.
Or like, sorry I had to hear it.
She gave him a look. A round tourist and his equally round wife jostled past their table, no, toward their table, and sat down at the adjacent two seats, which put them about 3 centimeters away from Franny's and Charles's elbows.
No, like, sorry he was such an asshole. I really mean it.
Fran had stopped eating and had her hands clasped in front of her chest.
When he married me, he married you. You know what I mean? He shouldn't have said it, simple as that.
Their neighbors to the left were from Germany. The husband had a Minolta around his neck on a bright yellow strap, all the easier for the thieves to spot. His wife held the map. Charles wondered if she thought she would still need it, to find the bathroom or maybe her way out. He almost couldn't believe they were there, the second most famous Jewish deli in the city. Some kind of reparations, he supposed.
Oh, Fräulein, let's order the pastrami and set things right.
They were dressed in somewhat archetypal tourist fashion, shorts and hiking boots, but with knotted sweaters tied around their shoulders should a chill appear later in the day. No doubt they had umbrellas in their rucksacks. Charles imagined he and Franny dressed up like that, with baseball hats and thick socks, tromping around some foreign place, their sunglasses too large for their faces. She would hold the map, and he would paint her portrait in 1,000 tiny towns. Charles looked across the table and smiled. Fran returned the smile, her mouth open and wide, with beige flecks of tuna wedged in between almost every tooth. She was a total wreck, and he loved every inch of her. He wasn't her husband, or her son, or her office mate. Charles got the sunny side of her, the good face. The best bits were always for him.
Puttanesca.
Laura and Stephen were set up by their therapist. It was after they'd both quit going to their bereavement support groups, and didn't seem any weirder than being set up by your divorce lawyer, which had happened to a couple of Laura's girlfriends. Rose suggested they meet at a Starbucks, somewhere public, where hostility and anger weren't allowed. Laura picked the one closest to her job at the magazine. She often saw blind dates take place there, nervous conversations with too much talk about the exes. It was the working girl's way of multitasking, screening potential suitors on their lunch breaks. She picked an empty table with a view of the street and kept her sunglasses on so that she could scrutinize all the single men with impunity. Three were bald, which would have been fine. One had glasses and a weedy frame. Surely that was him. She described John to Rose. Would she send her a replacement husband, as though John had been an ill-fitting sweater, finally swapped for the correct size? One guy looked like a quarterback and began wandering around in between the tables after buying his venti latte. She watched him circle the other tables of single women, who stayed focused on their laptops. He was tall, over 6 feet, and looked like the kind of boy who'd had lots of girlfriends in high school. He had probably been on the lacrosse team or soccer, something sun-kissed and surrounded by cheering fans. It had never rained where he grew up, she just knew it. Laura slid her sunglasses to the top of her head. "Stephen," she said, sure that she would be speaking into thin air, that the quarterback would shake his head and probably laugh when he got outside. Laura wasn't unattractive, she knew, but hers was a subtler kind, unplucked eyebrows and sensible footwear. He looked startled, like a baby next to a popped balloon just before the tears started to flow. But then the momentary look of panic was gone, so absent, in fact, that Laura was sure she'd imagined it. "Laura?" he said. Stephen was already smiling when he slid into the seat across from her, as easily as if she and everyone else at the Starbucks had somehow wandered into his living room. "Looks that way," Laura said. Her hair felt even more brown than usual, like mouse fur or dry dirt.
"Hi."
At least it was long again. After John died, she chopped all her hair off, up to her ears. Her mother said she looked like Joan of Arc, who Laura thought probably didn't have a mirror. It had not been a compliment.
"Nice to meet you," Stephen said.
His teeth were beautiful products of adolescent orthodontia, straight and well-spaced. Rose hadn't mentioned the teeth. In fact, Rose hadn't mentioned anything, other than that Stephen, too, had lost his wife and was chafing at the uniformity of the aged female participants of the bereavement group he'd been attending. She definitely hadn't mentioned his shoulders, or his lion's mane, which crested and cooled at Laura as though it had a voice all its own, each blonde curl telling her why this couldn't, wouldn't, shouldn't work. Laura had been to Rome before, some 10 years previous with John. They hadn't yet married, but the trip, in the honeymoon of their relationship, was overflowing with the kind of romance that nauseates fellow travelers with all its public kisses and fondling. But that was a long time ago, and Laura felt almost certain she was ready to go back. After all, Rome had been around for centuries and centuries without her, and without John, and surely it wouldn't bear the mark of his loss. She would have to do that alone, and hope that Rome didn't recognize the scar and offer her damp, sorry weather in return. If she wasn't ready now, then she might never be, and better to try than to stay home with the cat. After pushing for a Roman holiday for several months, Stephen was excited and booked a room in a boutique hotel on the piazza in front of the Pantheon. It was a small building, only 5 stories high, with only 2 hotel rooms per floor. They were on the very top. Outside their window, the dome of the Pantheon arched gracefully into the sky, until the roof itself opened up, as though the two couldn't stand to be apart a moment longer. The hotel was expensive, more than $500 a night, but Stephen paid happily. He'd been rich his whole life and found the idea of money rather embarrassing. In truth, the room probably cost even more than he had admitted. The hotel clerk had 1 good eye, 1 bad. The one on the left looked at them, and the one on the right examined the crown molding. He explained to them the concept of the elevator. They tried to catch the good eye and nod, letting him know they understood.
The door, yes?"
he pointed, jabbing his short finger in the direction of the elevator shaft. Laura and Stephen nodded in unison.
"The door close, or elevator no move. Door close, must close."
He wagged the finger again for emphasis.
"Must close."
The good eye narrowed. He doubted them already. His finger looked like an Italian sausage, full of red bloody specks. He must have been in his mid-70s. Laura wondered what he was doing there. Even if he owned the hotel, surely there was a son. A grandson, someone who could do this for him. The good eye found her staring in